If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, September the 22nd, 6 weeks until Election Day, and welcome back to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution, as well as the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guest today, joining me from somewhere in a much cleaner air Bay Area, is my colleague Marcos Kounoulakis. Marcos is a visiting fellow here at the Hoover Institution. He also writes a foreign affairs column for the McClatchy chain of newspapers, which means you'll see his wise words on the likes of the Miami Herald and the Sacramento Bee. Marcos, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Bill. I'm able to breathe in California, which is always a positive thing.
That's good to hear. I want to talk about the world beyond America's shores, but first let's tend to a little Kounoulakis family business.
Okay.
You know where I'm going with this. Your lovely spouse, Eleni, is Lieutenant Governor of California. Let's make a little news here in case Kamala Harris gets a promotion in 6 weeks. How does the sound of Senator Kounoulakis sound to you?
Well, I'm sounds sorry, good
I mean,
to me.
I mean your wife, not you.
That's what I figured. Sounds good to me, but of course, any such thing, any such development is predicated on a couple of very big things. One is a Biden-Harris ticket winning, and secondarily, what is the decision that one single person makes? And that is, of course, Governor Gavin Newsom. And I have no insight into what his thoughts, ideas, strategies, and plans are. But in terms of whether you're asking me if I'd be happy with that, sure, that'd be great.
Your old stomping grounds, right?
That's right.
Okay. How is life as a, you technically, you're the second partner, right? Is that the phrase we'd use for you?
So it depends on who you ask, because there's been a little Wikipedia war between whether I should be second gentleman, which is the traditionalist approach, or following the nomenclature that Jennifer Siebel Newsom has developed as first partner, I am therefore second partner. And so there's been this wonderful back and forth on Wikipedia as to whether I'm second gentleman or second partner. I go with partner.
How about second dude?
That would be good. I think it was it Bill Clinton who had phrased the term was first laddie. So I can be the second laddie.
Now you sound like a dog. That's not good. But you know what you could do, Marcos. I remember back in Washington, back in the 1980s, there was a column in the Washington Post. It was called "Wife of," and I think it was written by the wife of the Canada's ambassador to the U.S. And she just kind of chronicled life in Washington as a spouse of somebody. Because the joke was she's always referred to as, "Oh, she's the wife of so and so." So you could do a husband of column.
That's right. Call it plus one. And, interestingly, Bill, I wrote a column last year really looking at this issue of how does society manage this growing number of political spouses who are male? And it's not just male political spouses who are married to female politicians, but also, you know, people like Pete Buttigieg's partner. So right. And I had interesting experiences while overseas when I was the spouse of a U.S. ambassador. And it's always fairly, it's different in terms of societal expectations and norms and how you deal with them. But the reality is we're getting a lot more of them. And so I'm at least not in a lonely field.
Yeah, I agree with you. So, Marcos, there is a presidential debate a week from today, I believe, the 29th in Cleveland, Ohio, if I'm not mistaken. And I always am interested in presidential debates in this regard, Marcos, not so much who won or who lost, because that's subjective. I'm always curious, Marcos, as to what gets left off the table, what doesn't get brought up. And I have a strong hunch that given the events of the past week with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, given the pandemic, given the economy, given Donald Trump, that we're not going to spend much time talking about the world beyond America. And that concerns me. I'd like to get your thoughts on foreign policy as it pertains to this election, but let's start with the column that you wrote last week. The headline was, "In Iran and Egypt, the pursuit of happiness is almost criminal." Can you explain that column?
Yeah, basically, I started with a local hook because, of course, you know, when we're writing for our audiences, you want to make sure that there's a relevance to what it is we read here in the United States. And so I started with John Lewis and his favorite song, Happy, which was what was sung and danced to at the end of his funeral. And so
Pharrell
that
Williams,
particular,
right?
this is a song by Pharrell Williams, right? And it's a delightful song that's gone viral, and it's got a beautiful video attached to it. And there are these great videos of John Lewis dancing to it. Mm-hmm. Fine. That very same song is one that Iranian students and co-eds were arrested for singing and dancing to just a short while ago, around the same time that Lewis discovered this tune. And so my conceit here is that one of the things that strengthens America is its diversity and its creativity and its innovation. But one of the things that also hinders other countries is their very suppression of those human desires and expressions. And so I talked about Egypt arresting people for doing Instagram photos of themselves or dancing in public or not covering their heads, young women, for instance. And of course, the case in Iran as well. And so I compared those two. And I suggested, of course, that it's illegal, in fact, in some countries, to do what is fundamental in the United States, which is the pursuit of happiness.
Right. Right. Now, Iran interests me right now, Marcos. Yesterday, the U.S. announced that it's going to reimpose sanctions on that country. Other nations apparently did not get the memo. They seemed reluctant to go down the sanctions route again. Meanwhile, there is this rather remarkable story that most Americans are probably not aware of, and that was the Iranian authorities rather hastily executing a gentleman named Navid Afkari. My apologies if I mispronounce that, Marcos, but I believe it's Navid Afkari. He was a champion wrestler, and he was executed on September the 12th for allegedly killing a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He said he was tortured to confess, and he said these words shortly before he died, quote, "If I'm executed, people should know that in the 21st century, Iran still executes innocent people." For all of the problems that we have in this country with race relations, with criminal justice, with our societal reforms, a story like this is still shocking nonetheless.
It is. And, you know, the ICRG is essentially, you know, the shadow government in Iran. And this Revolutionary Guard really does what it wants. And even though there is an ostensible supreme leader, Khamenei, you still have a power that essentially owns the means of production that works hand in glove with the clerics and the theocracy leadership of that country. It's just reprehensible, Bill. This and it's yet another example of what I tried to point out last week about the expression of what could otherwise be considered just innocent expressions of public preference, of interests, and of political beliefs. Mm-hmm. And the things that really make, I believe, and I think that's true for most of my colleagues at the Hoover Institution, makes our nation free and creative and democratic and independent. And it really is just an incredible advantage that we have to be able to express ourselves and also have free movement and all the other freedoms that come along with a democratic society.
Yeah, what can the U.S. government do in a situation like this, Marcos? Because it seems to me that we are an economic power, we're a military power, but also we're a vast moral authority as well. So what moral outrage can we express here?
Well, interestingly, on the death penalty, we don't have any moral authority,
right,
Bill. It is, in fact, the column I wrote 2 weeks ago is why is Bill Barr giving terrorists a free pass while executing American prisoners? As you know, he recently reinstituted the federal death penalty after two decades. And mm-hmm. Since July, there have been five prisoners who've been put to death via lethal injection. At the same time, today, as we speak today, Bill Barr assured and received from the British government the evidence necessary to prosecute these guys known as the Beatles, who executed the journalist Jim Foley, Stephen Sotloff. They were called the Beatles because they had British accents, and they pulled off these things and beheaded American journalists. But what Bill Barr agreed to was not to pursue the death penalty in their cases so that we could get evidence on these guys and be able to at least prosecute them and in the maximum case, be able to apply a life sentence to these eventual guilty parties.
Right. Meanwhile, Marcos, in Egypt, you have protests against Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's regime. Anti-government protesters taking to the streets at least 16 different sites over the weekend, holding banners, chanting slogans, calling on el-Sisi to step down. This sounds like a pretty bold step to take in a country like that.
I really just am so in awe of people who, under such circumstances and facing the persecutions and the certain difficulties that they're going to face both personally and for their families, can make these moves. It is a renewal of hope that that demonstrators for basic human rights still hit the streets knowing that they are really in a fight that they're likely to lose.
And this also, Marcos, this is a spawn, an offshoot of the 29 protest, right? 2019
yes.
protest. So what is the protesting about? What is at issue in Egypt?
Well, you know, it's unclear. I haven't followed those specific, if those all 16 are directly related to freedom of movement and freedom of expression, because we have a very complex environment in Egypt where, of course, el-Sisi took over by coup by overthrowing, in essence, the Muslim Brotherhood. And they weren't for freedom of expression and freedom of movement and all the other basic freedoms of democratic society. In fact, they were much more interested in reimposing Sharia law. So it is uncertain to me, because I just haven't followed it in this last week, how these demonstrations are shaping up. But the fact that they are demonstrating and trying to, in fact, get out into the streets and register their displeasure with this regime, I think, is still something that is awe-inspiring and that should be supported. But I don't, if their goal is to reinstitute and reinstall a Sharia law regime, I am certainly not in favor of that.
Right, but I bring this up because, again, we have an election coming up in 6 weeks. New presidents, if Joe Biden is a new president, sometimes they inherit situations they didn't recognize. Look at Jimmy Carter in 1976, and he walks into the situation with the Shah in Iran. Joe Biden could be looking at an explosive Egypt if he's president.
Yes, and that's not the only place, right? I mean, if you hopscotch the world, you see any number of destabilized areas and some that are trying to take advantage of whatever vacuum currently exists in American leadership around the world, but also that would be exacerbated in a situation, for example, where we don't have a presidential outcome on election night or even a month after the presidential election. So I think that there's a fair amount of risk that we're facing, whether it's the first term of a Biden-Harris administration or the second term of a Donald Trump administration.
Right. So the extent that foreign policy comes up on Tuesday, Marcos, Russia and China, let's assume, but probably not much more beyond that. Be surprised that they got into Syria, which news is developing there. U.S. forces are going back into eastern Syria, apparently, which means we could be reengaging with ISIS again. But you mentioned hotspots around the world. Why don't you take us on a tour of the globe, Marcos? Take us east, west, west, east, globally, through the poles if you want to, but walk us through a few hotspots.
Sure. And you're right, Bill. You know, in terms of American presidential politics, foreign policy rarely plays an important role. I mean, healthcare and all the other domestic issues really are first and foremost on the minds of the electorate. Certainly with the pandemic and the economic dislocation that's occurring, that's going to be dominant. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, whatever judicial appointments may enter into the fray. But the world does not stop turning. And America's role in the world is still seen as one where we are meant to lead. In fact, today the president gave his United Nations General Assembly speech. So he approached the UN, the UNGA, as we refer to it. This is UNGA Week in New York.
UN General Assembly, right?
That's right, the General Assembly. And he approached this by basically laying out a bunch of domestic concerns and reasserting what he sees and how I've defined the Trump doctrine, which is every country gets to do what it wants. Sovereignty is the guiding principle, and America will therefore also be first amongst you to pursue a policy of America first. And so those are the conditions, and that's sort of the operating system that defines this administration and our foreign policy today. So,
is there a Biden doctrine at this point?
Yes, I think I think it's in contrast to the current administration's doctrine and aligned with what we would call the post-Cold War orientation of America. And that is, if you look at the Trump America First sovereignty doctrine and assume that within that doctrine, it is all about interests and the bare minimum is about values, I think the Biden doctrine, as it were, is finding that sweet spot of balancing American interests with American democratic values. And what do I mean there, right? So in the America First approach, we've articulated both during the Tillerson when Tillerson was our Secretary of State, that in fact, human rights would not play a role in the pursuit of our foreign policies. And that's continued not just in the way that we've articulated our policies, it's also borne out in the way that we execute our policies during the last 3+ years. In a Biden administration, what you're likely to see, and again, and I think this is fair to say in a Biden-Harris administration, because she too has worked quite diligently within the justice field, to find that balance where America can assert its values in the pursuit of its policies as long as they don't conflict with our interests. So rather than ignoring values entirely, or at least, you know, paying just a level of lip service to them, or using values to beat up those who are really our adversaries and use it as one more tool. And I, in this instance, for example, what you mentioned, China, the Trump administration talks about values of human rights and the Uyghurs, for instance, but it's used mainly as a cudgel in the pursuit of our larger China policy, rather than as leading with values as we have in other parts of the world.
Right. I do want to get back to those hotspots, but a couple more questions about Biden and this election. Al Gore runs in 2000 as an incumbent vice president. George H.W. Bush runs in 1988 as an incumbent vice president. Marcos, I think it's safe to say that Bush 41 ran as pretty much an extension of Ronald Reagan's foreign policy. I don't remember much about foreign policy in the 2000 election. This is more your area than mine, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not sure exactly where Al Gore would have deviated from Bill Clinton. I'm curious, though, if Joe Biden has deviated at all from Barack Obama, or if it would be seen as a continuation of the Obama years.
That's a good question, you know, and I think it's fair to say that, in fact, he would deviate, and we have the examples of where that is the case. Recall that when Barack Obama and when Joe Biden was running for president in that 2008 election, he, for example, was the guy who said we should deal with Iraq in a very different way than we dealt with it. He was looking at what was called the Biden Plan, for instance, which was breaking up Iraq into three separate areas, a Kurdish, a Sunni, and a Shia part of the country. Effectively allowing autonomous regions, three autonomous regions in what, you know, was essentially a nation that was already just kind of drawn on the map to begin with and had not paid much attention to cultural or tribal questions when it was drawn. So that's one example of how he really had asserted some very bold plans for an intractable problem that the United States was facing in an area where we were essentially mired militarily. You know, he's also, I think, much more assertive regarding alliances. And this is in part because of his personal experience. I mean, he has been on the scene for better or for worse, depending on where you fall on how you feel about Joe Biden. But he's been on the scene for a long time in foreign policy, whether it was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee or as vice president, where he was tasked by the president, by President Obama, to really be forward leaning on foreign policy issues. And right. So as a result of that, I think it's what we've seen is that he has these personal relationships and he really feels as if he understands regionally as well as geopolitically how the world works. I'd say there hasn't been a person who's had this level of insight and understanding of the world than George Herbert Walker Bush when he took over as president from Ronald Reagan. Someone who has a deep appreciation, respect, and understanding of America's leadership role and of the importance of alliances.
Now, Marcos, if you go back to the 1988 debates, I really doubt you're going to find anywhere in the transcripts either candidate, H.W. Bush or Mike Dukakis, saying the Cold War would be over in 3 years. If you go to the 2000 debate transcripts, I don't think you find George W. Bush and Al Gore talking that much about Islamic terrorism. The point is, presidents come in, they get dealt a hand, and it's not always the hand they necessarily have to play. You know, Bush 43 comes in, and he's pretty much a domestic policy president. He's a compassionate conservatism. He becomes a wartime president within the first year. H.W. Bush's presidency changes radically, both because of the end of the Soviet Union, but also the war in the Middle East. So this will be your cue, I think, Marcos, to now take us on the hotspots. Let's talk about a few places around the world that you think might be, well, debate worthy, if you will, just things we should be looking at and thinking about, what could be sleeper issues for the next 4 years for a president.
Right. Well, look, so the first thing I'd say is let's watch what the second administration or the first Biden-Harris administration tips us. How do they signal the way they're looking to the world, right? And you do that oftentimes with where you take your first trip. When Trump came into office, he went to Saudi Arabia and then, of course, did a Middle East swing. And what you've seen is, in essence, some success from that early move, right, in the recognition of Israel and the mutual recognition of Israel. So you can have some bearing if you act early on foreign policy. Otherwise, I think, Bill, your point is well taken, which is once you get into that office, you don't know what it is that's going to you're going to be facing and how you're going to react. And some of those hot spots are both near and far. I tend to think about how the hot spots intersect with American domestic politics. And when you do that, you cannot but help to look south of the border and what happens in Latin America. Latin America is key, not just for California regarding the relationship with Mexico, but if you are interested in that swing state of Florida and you look at the population there, you have three countries that they are very concerned with. One is, of course, Cuba. The other is Venezuela, and the third is Nicaragua. And so Venezuela has not been dealt with well. In fact, I would say that there has been a failed policy in the Trump administration of tipping the opposition to go and to try to overthrow the administration of Maduro, telling, you know, Juan Guaido, who was the head of the parliament, to just go. The United States is with him. The Vice President Pence called him the night before and said, go get him. And he's still sitting, on his hands as Maduro consolidates power and Venezuela remains even more of a mess than more than a year ago when this action happened. Right. In terms of hotspots, I think Latin America is definitely an area we have to watch. I'll mention one more thing that's interesting about Latin America. China, as our competitive, our strategic competitor, and I use that phrase strategic competitor because that's how China is looked at by the national security strategy and the national defense strategy that was shepherded by our colleagues Jim Mattis and by H.R. McMaster. So China is making very assertive moves into Latin America, knowing that there is a growing, you know, once a nascent, now a growing anti-Americanism within that region, an anti-colonialist streak within the politics of that region, whether it be Peronistas or others, Bolivarians, you name the country, though there will be this very apparent anti-colonial history and approach. And China has also recognized that they can cause a little bit of trouble down there, while at the same time helping to build some infrastructure and, for example, getting access to rare earths in Chile, for example. So they are actively using their Belt and Road Initiative and their investment strategies and their potential debt trap policies to ensnare some of our Latin American neighbors. And that is of significant concern for a country that once saw the Monroe Doctrine as the defining doctrine of how do we maintain primacy and a leadership role with our southern neighbors.
I'm curious as to your thoughts on Cuba, Marcos, what a second Trump term might have to offer for that island nation, but also what the Biden-Harris administration might do. Could they normalize relations with Cuba, or do 29 electoral votes speak loudly?
I think the electoral votes will speak loudly. And in fact, I think that the Biden Obama administration made a mistake in recognizing Cuba. I was all for the recognition. I just thought the timing was bad from a political perspective. They should have done it after the November election and before the installation of whatever administration was going to come in, whether it was Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. There's that sweet moment where a president has an awful lot of latitude to finalize foreign policy initiatives and to leave the next administration with basically a gift. Very difficult issues that they don't have to deal with. I think the second issue, for instance, that an Obama administration could have dealt with was recognizing Jerusalem, for example, during that lame duck period between election and the next administration in January 20th. So what will a Biden-Harris administration do? I think it's very difficult during those, if they get elected and then get a second term, very difficult to go to full normalization. But I think a pathway with milestones can be laid out. In the process, I think you will likely see a second term, you know, sort of after the first election, a second term early action towards normalization. And the final part of that, Bill, it depends on what happens domestically in Cuba. You know, the leadership can always flip, the populace can always react and demonstrate, and with a change in Cuban government, anything is possible, and those opportunities are ones that the United States is prepared to act on.
And I noticed in your list of Central American countries, Marcos, you did not mention Mexico.
Yeah, so Mexico is a difficult country. I mean, it's not difficult for California. We have we have good relations. And in fact, some of the things that the Trump administration have been very positive with Mexico, despite the rhetoric. Right. The reason I haven't really mentioned is we've already kind of come up with the follow-on to the NAFTA agreement. And with USMCA, as it's the US-Mexico-Canada agreement, we've sort of have solved some of the thornier trade issues. What remains is not so much a bilateral challenge between Mexico and Canada. What remains is the dominant issue of the 2016 campaign, which is immigration. And I think that is as much a domestic, if not more of a domestic issue than it is a bilateral issue.
Right. Now, you and I did a podcast a while back on Melania Trump, and it was a fun podcast, as I remember, because what we talked about was that she is a world citizen. She's from Eastern Europe. She speaks multiple languages. And what we talked about, it was a column that you wrote, I believe, which was the idea of her becoming sort of an ambassador to Eastern Europe, reaching out in unusual ways that American presidents cannot. Did anything come of that?
You know, not really, unfortunately. But there may be one exception. You know, we don't know, because we haven't been allowed any insight into that Russia relationship that President Trump has with Vladimir Putin. Very personal, seems very affable on its surface. And, you know, Melania, given the language she was brought up speaking, understands Russian. She was brought up speaking a Southern Slavic language. So I don't know to what degree, and by the way, this isn't the only Trump wife who comes from a Slavic-speaking nation. Ivana. Trump was Czech. And she, too, had the ability to converse in Russia, in Russian, I'm sure. In fact, when Don Jr. is on the road talking about his book, Donald Trump Jr., that is, he often talks about spending his summers in Czechoslovakia as a child, visiting his family, and the oppressive nature of those regimes at the time. But what I'm saying is that there is a first family right now that has a very different understanding and orientation towards Eastern Europe. I don't know to what degree that has been had any effect on this administration or the president, but I certainly do know that there is an access that hasn't existed in previous administrations.
Okay, a simple question, a naive question, but why does Eastern Europe matter?
Well, you know, it mattered during the Cold War because it was effectively the drape line across which the Iron Curtain was drawn. And so as far as the Soviets were concerned, they're buffer nations. They're the ones that really create this space between what they see as the offensive and threatening forces of NATO. That line has been moved closer to the Russia border than it once was. So it matters greatly to Vladimir Putin and to Russia and its self-perception, its understanding of empire. And it matters to the West. It matters to the United States because these now are, whether, you know, Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, you know, Slovakia, are all members of NATO and now also European community members. So they now belong to the community of democratic nations that are firmly rooted in alliances and relationships with us and with other Western countries.
Okay, we have not gotten to two continents yet, Asia or Africa. What could be something about Africa?
Well, Africa is interesting, you know, because it has had this incredible economic growth rate. I mean, and it's hard in time to speak about the continent as a whole, right? It is such an important place, and it is so disparate in its successes and failures. But if we look at it just on a straight GDP metric, the continent has been has had for the last decade plus enormous growth rates. Secondarily, Africa has dealt with this pandemic better than anyone else. Now, some are asserting that maybe there are medical reasons for a lower case of spread, or maybe even a testing reality that doesn't record all of the pandemic cases that may exist there. But nonetheless, it appears that they're weathering this storm fairly well, and they're coming out of their flu season, not going into it. So that's number two. And third, and I'd say this is where China again plays a very important role. China has looked at the African continent as a source of labor, a source of commodities, a place where they can play and have played for a very long time to establish beachheads, both militarily. If you look at the northern part in Djibouti, for instance, the relationship that they've tried to develop with Ethiopia, all near some of the most important oil and energy fields in the world. You know, in Ethiopia, they've built this amazing train network that allows people and goods to move from Addis Ababa to the ports of Djibouti. So you're seeing them play heavily, they're investing heavily, and they're also sending both workers and leveraging their Belt and Road Initiative and their investment bank to help in that growth on that continent, developing real infrastructure that is having an effect, an economic effect on that continent. So we have been effectively absent. The United States has effectively taken a pass on Africa during the last nearly 4 years. And even prior to that, we weren't really paying that much attention.
Right. And how would a Biden administration reboot that?
Well, it depends it's always going to depend on what crises occur. But I think you've already seen that there was some attempt in the second Obama administration to move into better relations with Africa. The Africa summit that President Obama had in a potential Biden administration, Susan Rice could play a more important role. She too has a great level of experience in Africa and interest in the continent. And I think you would see her really providing a great deal of insight and leadership in trying to counter first and foremost some of the moves that China are making. And secondarily, coming up with along with our defense leadership and national security structure, an understanding of what it is we're doing there. You know, Bill, we have something called AFRICOM. That's, you know, an African command. During this administration, during the Trump administration, we've lost American troops to terrorists on the African continent. What we haven't done, however, is establish what our policy is. What are our interests in Africa? And I think that that's long overdue. I wrote a column about this three years ago. We haven't done that much since. In fact, we're still there, and we don't know why. We're building drone airports in parts of Africa, for instance, for our drones and our drone pilots, so that they can conduct exercises against terrorists, Al-Shabaab, for instance, being one of them. But we haven't defined what it is we're doing there.
Interesting. You mentioned Susan Rice, so it sounds like you're making her the Secretary of State. But what about Mitt Romney? I thought he was going to be the Secretary of State, or maybe after today, that's not going to happen.
Who's that? I'm sorry, I missed it.
Mitt Romney.
Oh, Mitt Romney. I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, he would certainly take a lead role on Russia, wouldn't he? Given his interest in the 2012 debates.
Well, I'm kind of poking fun, Marcos, because he was. There's always talk in the administration of who's going to be the member from the other side to come in, and usually it's like a transportation secretary or something low. But there was actually talk of Romney coming in as either the Pentagon chief or even Secretary of State. But I have a sneaky feeling after what happened today with the Supreme Court nominee, it's not going to happen now.
Yeah, I think that's right, Bill. You're such a better observer of the domestic politics of America. It's really I have an ideal marriage, because we don't talk domestic politics or state politics at home very much. But my wife, as lieutenant governor, was made head of international trade and relations, and so we have this great ability to discuss foreign policy and international affairs. And of course, she's a former ambassador as well with a high-level security clearance. So I don't get involved in her business, but we certainly have fun talking about foreign policy and international relations.
She was a former ambassador to Hungary, October the 23rd, 1956. Marcos, what happens in Hungary?
It was a dark day. That was the day of the incursion of the Soviet troops into Hungary, putting down what was a domestic demonstration and move by the then Prime Minister Imre Nagy to pursue independence, in essence. I mean, not so much direct independence, but to try to achieve levels of independent freedom, and it didn't work out so well. The Soviets put that down in a very violent and aggressive, murderous way. In fact, that action, which eventually killed Prime Minister Nagy, was one of the reasons that Ronald Reagan became so assertive in his anti-communist push. It was the thing that sort of tipped him over to really recognize how dark communism, Soviet communism, and totalitarian states could be.
I mention this because not only do you have a personal connection to the country, but October 23rd, 1956 was 14 days before that year's presidential election. We have this phrase in politics, Marcos, October surprise.
Yes.
Some people will say the passing of Justice Ginsburg was the October surprise, though she passed away several days before October. But it's the idea that something you didn't plan on happens in the last few weeks of the election. Your hunch here, I mean, this has been a year full of surprises. Do you think there's another surprise waiting for us in October, especially on the foreign policy front?
Well, there are those that we can, that could come from Washington, D.C. and from the White House, and then there are those that are imposed upon us, right? That could then flip the perception of our politics. So from the White House on foreign policy, I think it's important that we keep our eye on what's going on in the Middle East. There have been some very interesting developments with the recent recognitions of Israel and the mutual exchange of ambassadors and diplomatic missions. I think that's a really interesting development. It's a very positive development, and I think you might see a Saudi relationship that formalizes. I think the Trump administration would very much like that. Certainly, Jared Kushner has been working on trying to develop that. So that's one thing that I think could really aid the administration and Donald Trump in his reelection efforts. Other than that, I don't see anything that's imminent or possible. I don't see anything happening in North Korea other than, in other words, I don't see the White House being able to answer or develop something positive with North Korea. I do, however, see Kim Jong-un maybe firing some rockets and watching their red glare causing problems in the election. That's almost a given, isn't it?
Just for the mischief of it, and that's kind of a Putin-like approach. And let's close out with talking about Russia's most famous American poll watcher, Vladimir Putin. Where has he been lately? What is he doing vis-a-vis this election?
You know, he's got his hands full. So on the one hand, he is continuing to do what he did in the last election, which is encourage those forces within Russia, some of which have direct relationships to the state, some of which have indirect relationships to the state, to Moscow and to his administration, encouraging them to cause as much havoc as possible. Not so much to tip the scales for one candidate or another, but really to just, you know, exacerbate the Black Lives Matter movement in ways that allow and reinforce division within our nation, exacerbate the debates and the questioning by our own electorate and populace as to whether or not this election is going to be legitimate. You know, taking the words of the president and even Hillary Clinton, who said, "Don't accept the results of election day," and then, you know, using those to whip up a frenzy of potential to delegitimize the election. And all you need in that environment on election day or shortly thereafter are instances where perhaps somebody tried to hack into an election machine, you know, and to create that level of chaos and havoc. So that's what he's doing on the domestic American political front. What he's doing internationally, as I say, he has his hands a little bit full right now, because next door is Belarus and Lukashenko. And so he's got to watch that shop very closely, because there's an opportunity for him to either use little green men or to maybe, you know, give Lukashenko a get out of Minsk free card and bring him to Moscow so that he can be next door neighbors with the former leader of Ukraine.
Right.
So I don't see him causing a whole lot of havoc on the international front.
Our Hoover colleague, H.R. McMaster, Marcos, he refers to this as Russian hybrid warfare.
Yeah. And you'll hear, and he's right, of course, and has more insight into this than most people, but it's also sometimes referred to as gray zone combat, which means all those types of wars that are being fought just short of kinetic activity and physical conflict. So, and in Russia's case, they are conducting that war 24/7. There is no sort of peace treaty signed at the end of it, and there's no bomb that goes off that indicates the beginning of it. It is an ongoing conflict that they have become expert at, and that they have really learned lessons of, and have been suddenly, really, they've been able to leverage both our open system and the digital world to really have force multiplying effect. Yeah.
Right. Final question for you, Marcos. This goes back to a really fine column you wrote. You look at Iran, and as you wrote, Iran operates on one concept with its population, and that's fear, plain and simple, fear. It's almost a play on FDR. If you're a leader of Iran, you say the only thing we have to fear is the fear of our people losing their fear of us. For Americans watching this election, Americans thinking about foreign policy, not so much what they should be afraid of, Marcos, but just what they should be concerned about at this point, given that we've been so obsessed with pandemic, the economy, the various sides of Washington. But if we look beyond the shores, what should the American people be looking at?
The unexpected hotspots, and that unexpected not so much for those who are watchers, but in general, we always have to watch what could happen between India and Pakistan. They are both nuclear armed states. They are both in a constant state of tension. We sometimes ignore what's going on there to our detriment, and I think that that's always a possibility. The second thing that I would say is, during this time when there's great caution on the part of Washington, D.C., and really we have an understanding that the Trump administration is conflict averse in terms of use of troops or military force in any assertive way, in particular with combat troops. What happens in the Taiwan Strait, Bill? there is a real opportunity right now for China in this moment to become a little more aggressive. They've done it in the South China Sea with buildup and arming of those islands, the Paracels and others. And we saw recently that they could do whatever they want in Hong Kong without any real significant retribution to them as a state. And Taiwan is the gold. It's the goal. What China, what Beijing looks at as a reunification process, is something that they could pursue. And so, any kind of aggressive move in the Taiwan Straits has the potential to just create unimaginable trouble for the world.
And the Taiwan Strait crisis, Marco's 1958 midterm election problem.
Yeah. Welcome back to 1958, 1956. It's all, you know, what is it? It doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme.
Well put. Hey, Marcos, enjoyed the conversation.
As did I, Bill.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Marcos Koutoulakis and his colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Marcos Koutoulakis is also on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @KoutoulakisM. That is spelled KOUNALAKIS, capital M, @KoutoulakisM. And he has his own website. Marcos, do you want to spell out your website for us?
It's my name, Marcos.
It's your punishment.
Yes, MarcosKoutoulakis.com, MarcosKoutoulakis.com.
Very good. I mentioned the fine writing you do for McClatchy. Anything else we need to plug?
No, you know, it's I do that, and I also spend a fair amount of time on a podcast myself called World Affairs. I regularly interview folks who are working in the foreign policy realm. It's run out of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and is on public radio stations across the country. That's always fun. And I'm working on another book. So I'll join you again when that's more relevant.
Okay. Do me a favor. Let me know if you're moving to Washington.
I'll let you know, Bill.
Okay. Take care, my friend.
Thank you.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.